Welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIEC, and it's a welcome home to our National Director, John Stevens. We are on tour in Solihull. John, welcome home.
Hi, Phil. Thank you. Good to be back here.
Could you do the whole podcast in a Birmingham accent?
All right.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's what we'll aim for. And Adrian, our Associate National Director. Hello, Adrian Reynolds. Good to see you.
Why are we here, Phil?
Well, we are here because we're having a planning day for FIEC, and this is the only opportunity we had to record. So we brought the kit with us, and
some
we brought the podcast here to Birmingham, to Solihull in particular.
Birmingham is a fantastic city. I lived most of my life here, was brought up here, went to school here, came back here, worked here, planted a church here. One of my kids has gone to university here. I want to plug Birmingham.
You could be the Andy Burnham of Birmingham, perhaps.
Well, there's a clue. We might get to that in a couple of moments. We're going to take our regular dive into the news. Before we get there, John, last week you were speaking at the Bala Ministers Conference in North Wales. Just tell us a bit about what you did there.
It was great. It was a gathering for ministers there. I wasn't the only speaker. I was doing a session thinking about issues of sort of nations, national identity, our identity in Christ, how that all works out into the current political and cultural context. So it was great to be able to talk about that and think that through. I think it's a really relevant and vital issue for Christians to think through at the moment. I was saying, actually, we have to approach it biblically. We need a biblical understanding of what nations are, how they fit into the plan of God. And above all, we need to realize that our identity as Christians is radically transformed and our identity is in Christ, which transcends all of our kind of earthly political allegiances.
And local conferences continuing, Adrian.
They do. There's not many left now. A few down in the southwest. So they're mostly done. And the feedback's been overwhelmingly positive from them, Phil. And I think that's because the subject matter is so, it's not just that it's engaging, it's actually important. People are really wrestling with what it means to be united in church.
Yeah.
As churches diversify, as we feel our differences of age, of culture, of gender, background, all kinds of different things. I think also FIEC churches are finding that people are coming to them from other church backgrounds and just wrestling with what that means and how it feels and what it looks like in church. A really big issue.
Liverpool yesterday?
Yeah, I had a great day in Liverpool yesterday. We were at Bethel Church. There are lots of FIEC churches across Liverpool and the Wirral and Chester, and actually a real diversity of churches. So some churches that are larger, student churches, city centre churches, suburban churches, lots of churches working in sort of smaller communities, some in deprived communities. There are some great stories of revitalizations and plants over the last 15 or so years. There was a real warmth of fellowship between the leaders sort of there. So that was great. I realised that the one area we didn't cover in church life, it was all about church unity, and we were talking about different areas like gender, age, ethnicity. We didn't cover how you manage to be a church that's united as red and blues in the same congregation.
It must be easier now Everton have moved slightly outside the city, so they're not just across each other.
Well, I did discover that one of the churches in an area that is called Everton is in fact right next door to Anfield, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yes. Yeah, you could see the stadiums.
It was basically a church split. Everton and Liverpool.
Yeah, it's true.
11 or 10 of the 11 players left and went across the road.
So Stanley Park separated the two stadiums historically, but it's no longer the case because Everton have moved to just outside the city. Anyway, back to local conferences. They're always based loosely on what we've done at the Leaders Conference, aren't they, Adrian, in terms of
we try and pick up a theme and do it in more detail. We're not enslaved to that.
And that's to say Leaders Conference bookings for this year are open.
They are. And the theme, as we said last week, is last time we were around, is Pour Out Your Hearts. Yeah, Leaders Conference bookings are open. The early bird closes on, Phil,
sometime in mid-July.
Yeah.
Joel will put it in the show notes.
Get your bookings in.
Very good. Very good. Let's talk about what's been happening in the news this last couple of weeks, brothers. We've woken up this morning to a new MP for Ashton and Makerfield up in the northwest of England.
You want to switch the initials around?
Sorry?
MP?
PM. Exactly. And that is what we're going to talk about. Because have the constituents there in Ashton and Makerfield, have they just chosen a new MP or have they actually chosen our new Prime Minister? John.
Well, I think that remains for what the Labour Party and Labour Party MPs are going to do at this point. It's clear there was going to be a challenge to Keir Starmer anyway. So where Streeting had said that he was going to challenge. So Andy Burnham has clearly been preparing to challenge the Prime Minister, wants to be Prime Minister. So whether he becomes the Prime Minister or not, I think remains to be seen. That depends what kind of contest there is. But certainly, I think it looks at the moment as though Keir Starmer is unlikely to continue as Prime Minister for very long. the party or the MPs will decide that somebody else ought to lead. So whether that's Andy Burnham or not, but certainly he is seen as a leading contender. And I think the degree of the vote that he received, the overwhelming 55% defeating Reform and Restore so significantly, obviously makes him a leading candidate.
Adrian, is this the right way to choose leaders?
Well, personally, I don't think so. But actually, we are stuck with a particular system, aren't we? The way that leaders are chosen, in terms of the rules that in this case, the Labour Party have, you have to be a sitting MP. It's worth remembering that Andy Burnham did try to be Labour leader before.
Yeah, he has.
The reason that he went to be mayor of Manchester was not because he really wants to be mayor of Manchester, I think, but because he failed to be the Labour leader. He lost that election. And I think... You know, he's the person that, is he the person that people want, or is it they don't want Starmer? I mean, these things are quite complicated, aren't they? And so there are always protest votes going on. Reform did very well in the local elections in this area, completely swept the board, because I think they were protesting against central government in Westminster. Now the votes protesting against central government in Westminster have gone to Andy Burnham. But it still ends up being a protest vote. So quite whether it's the ringing endorsement that he thinks it is, I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how the Labour Party at Westminster respond to him. Quite a few people have already come out and said they support him. But clearly Starmer is building up a war chest. We've been reading about that in the news today. And he's not going to go down, I don't think, without a fight. Unless he really does see the writings on the wall. But it seems messy. Mm. It seems awkward. But actually, over the last few years, we've seen this in the Conservative Party as well, that prime ministers are chosen by the vagaries of internal politics really within the party rather than any sort of national consensus.
Isn't that part of the problem, though, that this time we were told it was going to be different? If we voted for Labour 2 years ago, it wasn't going to be the infighting that we'd seen with the Tories. There would be stability. There would be an opportunity to fix what has gone wrong. It's all, the wheels have come off sort of within 2 years. There's analogies here, isn't there? When things aren't going well in church life, sometimes we can be quick to want to make sweeping changes, and we need to perhaps be more patient, John?
Well, I think that's difficult, isn't it? I think the Labour Party was elected promising change and that life would get better very quickly. And there was obviously this massive disappointment across the nation about what the government has done, the problems it's not been able to solve. You might say the root issue was a failure to have ever been honest with with the public as to the scale of the challenge and what would be needed.
Or even honest with themselves.
Labour had promised they wouldn't put up certain kinds of taxes, which basically it limited their ability to be able to invest in public services and do things that people wanted. Issues like small boats are intractable. Nobody's got an easy solution as to how to stop people coming across the channel. It's difficult to remove people when they have arrived because nobody wants to take them back again. So there are some just deeply intrinsic problems. And I think Labour presented, we will be better than the Tories just because we're nicer. But actually, in the reality of government, the issues haven't gone away. So one of the challenges of leadership is being honest with people about the scale of what's involved. And it's very easy for people to say, I'd be a better leader, I'd be a more popular leader, I'll be able to solve these problems, but not actually to have really provided proper solutions to them. So I'm not a Labour supporter, but I have a measure of sympathy for Keir Starmer. I mean, in some ways, some of the statistics suggest improvement. So the UK economy is the best growing of the G7. Migration figures have come down very dramatically from something like 900,000 to about 170,000 a year. There have been some significant changes that have taken place. Interest rates have stayed the same. Inflation has not risen quite as much. And he has been unlucky in terms of having to deal with Donald Trump and having to deal with a war in Iran. So all of those things have made his premiership, I think, extremely difficult and have probably meant he hasn't been able to do what he wanted to do. At the same time, he's not been able to communicate a vision. And I think in that sense, he has kind of lost the room and lost the support of the public more widely and increasingly of the party. And I think there is a point at which leadership is always by consent, whether it be in a church context or anywhere else. And you need to have people supporting you and behind you to be able to lead. And that's true in church life as well. There are points at which leaders, it may not even be completely their fault. There may be circumstances, it may be personality, in which you've just lost the ability to keep leading this group of people. And it's no longer in the best interests of the church to continue to be the person trying to lead it forward. So the person they stick to leading and fail to recognize that reality might actually cause long-term damage.
I think there was a danger, though, on the other hand, of putting too much faith in one person. So our system is quite hierarchical in the UK. The Prime Minister has effectively a lot of power and a lot of influence. But just by changing that one person doesn't change the underlying problems. Churches sometimes do have underlying problems. They're sometimes located in the wrong places. Perhaps they haven't shifted the culture and don't want to shift the culture. They're still sort of trying to reach 1950s Britain, for example, or there are other systemic issues in the church that haven't been fixed. And just changing a leader doesn't fix those things. Mm. So I think there is a danger if church life is not going well, or there have been some disappointments or discouragements. Just thinking that changing the leader will change that is a bit naive. And Andy Burnham, I don't think, has had a great track record, didn't have a particularly good track record as a minister. I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that actually the success he's enjoyed in Manchester has been on the back of some structural changes that were made before he turned up, and he's just kind of riding on the coattails of that. So, I mean, you could argue he's got a slightly embellished CV, that actually he's not quite been the leader that he claims to have been. And time will tell, if he does become the Labour leader, whether he can prove to be a better leader than Keir Starmer. I think what is clear is he's a better communicator. I think John's absolutely right about that. And being able to communicate our vision to the church is really critical. Mm. And elders in church can have great ideas and great plans and have thought about them very carefully. But if they're very poor at communicating them, sometimes things that they've been chewing over and thinking about for months on end just don't come across to church members, and they think, well, why should we do that? So actually being able to communicate is important. And it's not just being able to preach well. This is being able to communicate something of your vision for a church and what that means, I think, is a really key part of a strategy of a leader. I think you do get a sense of that in the Bible qualifications, the idea of piloting the ship, the kubernesis word that comes in 1 Corinthians 12:28 gives a sense, you know, there's a sense of leadership in that. You're able to give direction. Mm. That's the idea. I think that's part of the meaning behind the word. And I think we've neglected that part of vocabulary when it comes to leadership.
Politics is a brutal business.
Yeah.
And actually in politics, so much of issues over leadership are driven by personal rivalries, ambition. There's constant scheming, various groupings trying to get their person put forward. It's quite clear that that's gone on in every cabinet, in every government. That's an area where I think the church ought to be different. Yeah. The Bible warns us against those personal rivalries and ambitions in leadership. So where you have in a church, people trying to bring a leader down because of their own personal ambition and they want to be the one who's leading, that can be a dynamic that is incredibly damaging to church. And I think churches shouldn't be like the political world in which you have that sort of personal rivalry playing out. There is a right and proper respect for leaders, submission to leaders, support for leaders. Mm-hmm. There is also a place for the time when leaders need to step back and sometimes need to be asked to step back. But we really shouldn't see church leadership as being the equivalent of that political rivalry.
No. And it's important as well, we've got to say what we're able to do and not make promises that we can't keep when we're standing for leadership. We were talking on the car on the way here about Count Binface, for example, basically as a parody politician. He's saying, oh, yeah, I'll lower your taxes by raising everybody else's. And all that kind of stuff.
I'd vote for him, yeah.
But it just can't be done, can it? So you've got to have an honesty as well.
I think the other difference is we have without wanting to sort of push the analogy too far, the Prime Minister is the boss. So we do have a royal family, but they're largely constitutional. And we have a king who is head of the church. He's not a constitutional monarch. He is head of the church. He does have a say in how church is and how it's run and what it should look like and what it should do. So a pastor is not the equivalent of a Prime Minister in that sense. He is actually he's an under-shepherd, and very clearly an under-shepherd alongside the other elders.
Yeah,
I think so. And you never really know the pressures of leadership until you're actually in that position. I think it's very easy for people who are not leaders to think, I could do a better job. I'd understand what needs to be done. I'd be able to solve problems that others haven't been able to solve. But then when you find yourself in the position of having to lead, you've got all of the competing priorities that you have to bring together. You've got all of the pressures of the different demands of different groups to be satisfied. So I think sometimes it's very easy to look at leadership at a distance and think, I could do that and do that more easily, but not to have actually really appreciated some of the challenges that are involved. And so it's easy for us to look at other leaders and think somebody else could do that better. And I think sometimes spiritually, we actually end up sadly thinking that in relation to God.
Yeah.
I think sometimes our praying, the way that we talk can almost sound as though we're basically telling God how he ought to do things and that they would be done better if they were done our way. And again, I just think we need that measure of humility that recognizes we may not have the gifting, the knowledge, the understanding to be able to actually lead better. Actually, the Bible has a lot to say about supporting your leaders and appreciating your leaders.
John, this was a story you picked out that we talked about and we were planning for this morning about the Church of England and the government apologizing for forced adoption. So this goes back several decades when women were basically hidden from society when they were pregnant out of wedlock and their children were taken from them and given away in adoption. Both the Church and Parliament going to apologise for their role in that. John, what's your take on that? You've got quite a personal link to this kind of story, haven't you?
Well, the heart of the story is that these often young teenage mothers had wanted to keep their children, but the shame that they were experiencing, the way that others treated them, basically put pressure on them to give their kids up for adoption. And that continued really right up into the sort of early 1970s. I mean, yeah, I've got a very personal connection with that. I was adopted as a child. My mother was a 16-year-old schoolgirl who clearly got pregnant. I happen to know that she was in a mother and baby home that was run by the Church of England here in Solihull. That was where I was adopted from. I don't know a great deal more than that. I have no idea whether or not she was in any way coerced or pressured to do that, or whether that was the right thing to do at that point. So I don't know the exact circumstances, but I can resonate with that situation. And at one level, I have some mixed emotions, because being adopted, I was adopted by a loving family and had great opportunities that came as a result of that I probably wouldn't have had if I'd been brought up by a teenage mother in a kind of a single home situation. So adoption also brought tremendous privileges for me, but she may well have experienced that kind of shame and pressure. And of course, society as a whole has changed. It wasn't just these institutions. The whole of society was negative towards sort of girls who got pregnant or single mothers, and there wasn't the financial support for them. I think as a recognition of what was done in the past, I don't think for a moment that was a better period. I think sometimes Christians can look back to the 50s, the 60s, the 70s and think attitudes towards sex and marriage and relationships were altogether better. Well, they clearly weren't for people who found themselves in that situation. It wasn't compassionate. It wasn't supportive. And I think at the same time as apologizing for that, we ought to recognize the other massive thing that has changed is that today, of course, abortion has been introduced.
Yeah.
The Abortion Act came into effect in 1967. It actually only came into force just before I was born, so I wasn't within the scope of when legal abortion was available at that stage. Today, there are something like 250,000 abortions in the UK per year.
Scandalous.
So the way we actually deal with unwanted pregnancy has become abortion rather than adoption, and all of those lives are lost. So I think it reflects on the way that the people were mistreated in the past. Actually, we are mistreating in an entirely different way through the abortion of so many babies this time round. I guess I feel kind of quite personally involved in that as a story. And I think the challenge is, how do we deal in a way that is compassionate and right? I think Christians need to think, if they want to be against abortion, they have to be ways of providing and enabling those who've become pregnant to be able to have those children, bring them up in an adequate style of life with proper support for them. If you don't provide that, of course you build in an incentive to abort rather than have children.
What's the place of apologizing for past mistakes? I mean, we see this in a number of different areas, don't we? And, you know, I guess our churches are less likely to have been built on slavery money, for example, but some of our churches are old. And we've got churches dating back to the 1600s. And so some churches may well have links that they're either unaware of or that they are aware of, don't know what to do about some of these issues. What's the place of our responsibility today, being in institutions, being in churches specifically, I guess, that might have links in the past?
Well, I think my personal view is, if you look back to something like that, I don't think it's about apologizing in terms of repenting for sin that was done by others at an earlier time. I don't think that really makes a great deal of sort of sense. We're responsible for our own sins, particularly under the new covenant. I don't think it's about sort of repenting in relationship to God. I do think there's a point of acknowledging and recognizing that wrong was done. And in apologizing in that sense, you are owning up to the fact that this was not the right thing to have been done at that time. In doing that, you are comforting the people who were affected by that. And you were also saying you are not going to do this in the future. So I don't think we necessarily have to put it quite into the category of repentance and forgiveness of sins in those ways.
There is a category for it.
But I think there's a right and proper acknowledgement of wrongdoing. In fact, even in some circumstances, restitution to put right that wrongdoing at a human level.
It touches on pastoral issues as well, though, doesn't it? Because there might be people in our churches who are impacted by this policy. John, you've described your own situation. Mm. But there might also be those who've been impacted by abortion as well. Yeah. How do we speak wisely and pastorally into some of those things?
I think we have to take great care in generalizing. I think people find themselves in different situations for all kinds of reasons. For example, you might have a young woman in your church who has had an abortion, and there may be a myriad of reasons why that was the case. You know, was she a Christian? Was she not a Christian? Was she coerced? Was she not coerced and put under pressure? And all kinds of other questions alongside that. So I think we need to be careful about making general sweeping statements. And we've talked about this before, haven't we? Without realizing that people in front of us are real people with real backgrounds and real pastoral issues and things that they're wrestling with and will find difficult. So I think on the one hand, we have to be firm, I think in general terms, about what we think are the evils of abortion. Mm. We do think it's the taking of a life, and we need to be clear about that. But on the other hand, I think for dealing with those who perhaps have had abortions, we need to be very sensitive in terms of personal circumstances and situations. And I think we have to be just careful of wading in with both feet, you know, like a two-footed challenge gets a red card. I think in that kind of pastoral approach can be very clunky and clumsy and not particularly kind and compassionate. We need to understand, we need to speak into situations with grace and love and not just condemnation.
I mean, the great task of the church is to minister God's grace to sinners who've repented so that they can be fully forgiven and restored. And I think this is an area where we need to grasp the true extent of God's grace, that somebody who has either had an abortion or a man who's pressured somebody into having an abortion and is therefore complicit in it, if they trust in Christ, there is complete forgiveness. And I think we need to be kind of making clear that is fully forgiven. Actually, God no longer remembers. That's what he promises in his word. Sin is removed as far as the east is from the west. There should be no ongoing burden of guilt and shame that's imposed by the church. Instead, there should be the freedom and the forgiveness that the gospel brings. And I think most Christians carry burdens from sins they've committed, whether in fact or sins they've committed in their minds, things that they might have committed. That burden of shame is something that the gospel is there to remove. And I think we need to remember the gospel deals with all aspects of the consequences of sin. It deals with our guilt, but it does also deal with our shame. And I think actually that's the great message that we have to proclaim. And we ought to be communities in which we are lovingly celebrating the forgiveness of the gospel. And that's what the church is all about. And then proclaiming that good news to others who are in society. I think sometimes we think it's our job to make everybody feel guilty, whereas in actual fact, lots of people feel a burden of guilt. And we just need to, in a sense, be that what they're surprised by is the forgiving grace that's available in the gospel.
Which is the heart of the gospel message, isn't it?
And I think we need to recover the doctrine of adoption.
Yeah.
I think that's an underrated Christian principle. And it ties back to what I was talking about at Bala and identity. Actually, as Christians, we are all adopted. Actually, whenever we become a believer, we are adopted as children of God. We have a new identity. We have a new father. We have a new family. And I think radically grasping that adoption is a core way of thinking about what it means to have become a Christian is just really significant. And I think we can place far too much emphasis in Christianity on the biological family rather than actually seeing that in the New Testament, we become part of a spiritual family by adoption. And I think that's a neglected area.
The final story we're going to talk about, brothers, is something that was announced on Monday morning, which was a plan to ban social media for under 16s. It was a headline statement. The nuances of that will be worked out in the months to come. All sorts of commentary about that in the intervening period since Monday morning. There's a recognition, isn't there, that social media is not serving under 16s well in terms of the pressure it's placing upon them, in terms of some of the things they're exposed to on it. But what do we make of this idea that just banning it will solve this?
Let's go back one step. I think there's a recognition that social media is more damaging than just to under 16s.
Oh, it's damaging to all of us, I think.
So I think we need to, you know, this is particularly about protecting people who are vulnerable. and children. But actually, a bit like smoking, there is a recognition that it has damage beyond that and has damaged society beyond that. But actually, this is about a particular piece of legislation.
Yeah, and I think it's not just about coming across harms on social media. It's about how it shapes our thinking and our lives. So actually, if you're growing up in a world of social media and everything is documented, I mean, any mistake you make, I think back to our own childhoods, if everything you did between the ages of 12
every
and 16,
opinion you ever offered,
absolutely, was all there.
And we've seen that a bit, actually, going back to the by-election. We've seen that by-election.
Well, precisely. And I just think that is so it's not just about harms children come across. That in itself means, I think, they can't grow up able to make mistakes. Maybe I'm overreaching. But anyway, my take is this is a good start, a good step. But it isn't going to solve all the problems, is it?
Well, it's certainly not going to solve all of the problems. I mean, it is a start, and it's a recognition that phones can have a damage, or social media can have a damaging effect on the development of children. And I think it's rather like the smoking ban, or it's like the introduction of safety features in cars. Probably this is the beginning of a dealing with what is an increasingly recognised a problem. And we have to recognise that the social media companies and the tech companies and the phones, they've had a vested interest in building systems that become addictive, because they're basically interested in making money, harvesting data, keeping your attention. The whole invention of scrolling, the whole way the algorithms operate, they are basically designed to make you addicted. So these companies are sort of exploiting both the technology and people's vulnerabilities. And it clearly is very difficult for parents to exercise any degree of restraint. So children are spending hours a day on social media. That means they're not sort of getting out there in the world. They're not engaging with real people. We see sort of damages in terms of specific content that is deeply disturbing, particularly sexual and pornographic. We've seen the impact of people being drawn into committing suicide because of what they sort of see online. So there are genuine harms that are there. I was interestingly at a kind of a lecture by Professor Glyn Harrison, who was speaking at the opening of a new hall at Hailey, the conference center. And he was talking about, from psychological research, the danger that phones pose in terms of undermining our ability to pay attention to anything, that they are designed, or they have the effect of preventing us from actually concentrating and paying attention to the things that are most important. That significantly affects the development mentally of children and young people as they grow up at periods in their life where their brain is still developing. That continues until your early 20s. I think actually as adults, we're massively affected by that. We mustn't think that social media is just a problem for children. It's actually a massive problem for society. And I think people can't pay attention to anything in the way that they used to be able to. And actually, we see that in its impacts in church ministry and spiritual life. Actually, biblically, in order to grow, we need to effectively pay attention. We need to pay attention to God, we need to pay attention in prayer, pay attention to his word. And actually, what social media and phones have done is it's removed from many of us the ability to actually give sustained attention to anything, and therefore we don't grow to maturity. So I think there's a much bigger set of issues on, but this is an important start.
Yeah, I mean, as a dad of a seven-year-old, I'm really pleased with this news because we're at the point where we don't have to take anything off our daughter because she hasn't got it yet. But this will be a good guardrail for us. But it's still my job as a dad to look at what she's looking at, to make sure I'm protecting her and parenting her through that, isn't it? So there have been kind of nanny state vibes from some over this, Adrian. Is that fair?
I mean, we do believe in freedoms, don't we? But as we talked about with other areas, like, for example, free speech, there are also boundaries. And those boundaries, I think, are rightly set by government. And where there's empirical evidence, as there is here, I don't think parents should be too worried by that. We should go with it. I think Jean Twenge has said quite a lot about this.
She has.
And it's an American psychologist, and I don't think she's
sociologist.
I don't think she's a Christian. She may be, I don't know. But she has sort of identified the smartphone as being one of the things that really has held back the maturing of teenagers especially, and the reason that people in their early 20s and late teens are not as mature as they were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, by a considerable amount, by a number of years, in effect. You know, an 18-year-old is like a 16-year-old, a 16-year-old is like a 12-year-old, is because of the smartphone. And she says that there have been other technological developments which have had similar impacts over the years. And actually have been unregulated and have done terrible damage. And the big one really is the television and how the television impacted people's lives, or the screen in front of people. So I think it's not that these things are intrinsically bad, it's how we use them. But at the extremes, I think it is right to legislate. So you're describing an area where you operate in the middle as a parent. You're trying to operate in a way that's wise and is godly and is thoughtful. But at the extremes, it's right that there are boundaries.
Yeah, we need guardrails, don't we? Yeah. I read somewhere somebody saying that we wake up and we look at a small screen. We go to work, we look at a medium-sized screen. We entertain ourselves in the evening with a big screen and go to bed again with our small screen. That should terrify us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the modern culture, much of our life is lived in a disembodied way. We're not engaging with what's in front of us. We're not engaging with real people. So for many people, they are more engaged with fictitious characters that they're watching on television screens than they are with real people in their lives. Or they're engaging online with people they have no real human connection with. And I think that actually is not the way we're designed to be. God designed us to be embodied people relating in particular communities. And actually, one of the beauties of the church is that the church is a gathering of people who genuinely relate to one another, who meets together in an embodied form, hear God's word, care for one another, love for one another. And I think that's actually a really precious thing that actually for many people in society, they don't have anymore. And I think we need to emphasize the vital importance of that embodied connection.
And it's an evangelistic opportunity. People are turning up at church looking for that.
Yeah.
People turning up at church looking for a relationship. And we're hearing story after story, we've heard it in our church, of people who are converted. And they say the thing that really struck them most of all was how people related to one another.
Yeah. They care for each other.
One another. Yeah, and that's a story that's as old as history, actually, seeing how these Christians love one another.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think we need to recognize that phones, social media, they are a species of addiction. Mm. Actually, again, Glyn said something very interesting. How do you discover if you're addicted to something? We'll try to do without it for a while.
Yeah.
And you know, if you turn off your phone or you put it down and you find you're sitting there and you're kind of constantly wanting to reach for it or go for it, basically you've become addicted to it.
Yeah.
And actually the Bible sort of warns us about those kinds of addictions, and we need to, in a sense, free ourselves of them.
Yeah. You mentioned smoking ban, seatbelts in cars, for example. It can change a culture, can't it? And we just saw as we finish a little bit of that with the Japan fans at the World Cup. Adrian, you picked up on this. So this is it's a cultural thing, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, it's not just football, by the way. It happens at all kinds of events. Mm. That I mean, the football fans, the Japanese football fans have made a virtue of it. So they come and throughout the game, they wave blue bin bags above their heads, a bit like other teams wear scarves. And then at the end of the match, they clear up after themselves. So there is an embedded culture, which has become something that has actually not just become a chore, but has become a virtue, which I think is the interesting point you want to get to, when things don't just become a burden upon you. Good things don't just become a burden, but they become something that you celebrate.
Yeah.
I think that's what you're seeing with the Japan fans.
Yeah, interesting.
I think that reflects on the relationship between law and spirit and old and new covenant. So you could law has a place, doesn't it? And laws don't litter, don't fly tip. Sort of, there's a place where that's needed. And actually you need to deal with those who break the law with fines or penalties or whatever, because standards do need to be set. But that can create a culture. But what you ultimately want is for people to have so adopted those standards that they just do them because they believe them to be right. They've become internalized. And in a sense, that's exactly what the work of the Spirit does, in that he writes the law on our hearts, and what was an external code becomes an internal kind of way of life.
I haven't heard Mark Pugach on Radio 5 Live describing the Japan fans that way, but I'm very happy to go with it.
But it could be. Yeah. There we are. We're out of time, brothers. Thank you for talking about what's been going on in the news this past couple of weeks. Hope you've enjoyed the podcast. Do rate and review it so others can find it. And we'll look forward to speaking to you again in a couple of weeks' time. God bless.
See you.
Thank you.